The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. This past Thanksgiving, President Obama set aside his agenda on immigration to take part in an annual holiday tradition.
To spare the lives of two turkeys, Mac and Cheese, from a terrible and delicious fate.
It should come as no surprise that the president's daughters, Malia and Sasha, who are there with their dad, found this whole charade just as cheesy as the rest of us. And yet after the event, they were critiqued by some as looking like bored, disinterested teenagers. One particularly nasty Facebook comment went viral, and the internet hasn't been able to stop talking about it since. Now, anybody who remembers the exploits of the Bush twins less than a decade ago knows that gossiping about presidential progeny is nothing new. But as it turns out, the practice is as old as the White House. Jamie Fuller writes about politics for The Washington Post, where you'll find her article, The Long and Fraught History of Judging the President's Kids. And Jamie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, great to be on.
So you combed through the archives sort of looking for historic examples of presidential kids in the news. What was the earliest case you were able to find?
Well, in fact, there are many people who would argue that the Lincoln boys were the worst presidential kids of all. People who went to the White House were always terrified that they'd have to deal with these kids who would play pranks on everyone. And you can find lots of instances of people writing in their diaries when they got home, like, it was great meeting the president, but those kids, they get away with everything.
And in fact, you have a bit of news, a news clip here. It has somebody quoted as saying, had they expletive deleted in Lincoln's hat and rubbed it on his boots, he would have laughed and thought it was smart.
Yes. So I think the bar is pretty high for being a bad presidential kid.
Well, and it sounds like expectations were really different back then. So, you know, obviously this was long before TV, but do you think the political culture regarding the president's families was different too?
Oh, definitely. And you have the same thing with James Garfield, too. His kids were called holy terrors, and you can kind of sense the amusement that the country had about it. And there was very much, it felt kind of like a royal sense where people kind of loved the family and enjoyed watching them like their own. And now there's so much media that needs to be fed into all the time. It's kind of, there's a frustration that we don't hear much about the presidential kids. At the same time, the presidential families are being far more private with their kids, knowing that the media that they're going to have to deal with is far more than the delinquents would have had to deal with.
Well, yeah, and I think one of the reasons the internet so vigorously defended the Obama girls is that, you know, these are people that aren't seeking the limelight. They don't have a choice about whether or not to be members of the first family. But you did write about one presidential daughter in your article who actually loved that sort of attention, Alice Roosevelt. What was her story?
She was a character, and people have been writing about her for so long because she did amazingly interesting things. And she was Teddy Roosevelt's child by his first wife, who died. And she always felt kind of apart from the rest of the family. And the way she dealt with that is by doing lots of pranks and kind of messing around. And she would always carry a snake around with her to parties, and the newspapers would cover it in like humongous headlines, like, oh my goodness, there's a snake at the White House. And when McKinley died, she said that she experienced sheer rapture when it happened, which you can't even imagine anyone saying in those circumstances today. And she was just known as kind of the party child.
I can't imagine what that tweet would look like and how that would go over.
Yeah, no, exactly. And nowadays, before Malia and Sasha, you've like Teddy Roosevelt kind of was like, whatever, like he was kind of frustrated that his daughter was going to overshadow him on the front of the newspaper with her antics when he was doing important things too. But he would never kind of shush the press in the way that the Clintons and the Bushes and the Obamas have.
Well, yeah, I grew up during the Clinton era, and I always had this sense that regardless of whether or not the press always followed it, that the president's daughter, that Chelsea, was off limits. So when did that become a thing?
If you pay attention, you can kind of feel it happening with the start of the 24-hour news cycle. And when CNN became a thing, that was kind of when the president kind of shoved his family back into the house. And one thing you'll have with Chelsea Clinton is she was far younger than a lot of other presidential children who had been in the White House. And you see the same thing happening with Malia and Sasha, where they're so young that that's part of the protectiveness, even on top of the news cycle.
It's funny, when I was reading through your article, I realized that there's a difference, too, in how the president and the family has reacted. So when People magazine featured Chelsea in 99 on their cover, the Clintons put out just a very stiff statement sort of denouncing the decision, saying it was a regretful move on people's part. But in 1950, President Truman had a very different reaction to criticism of his daughter, Margaret. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, no. Margaret was trying to become a famous singer, and she would often perform in places that you could never imagine performing at that age unless your father happened to be the president. And a Washington Post critic kind of slammed her performance and saying she had a long way to go and just went on and on and on with the criticism. And when Truman saw that, he wrote a letter to the critic saying, like, threatening him and saying, "You better watch out. I'm coming for you if you do this again."
Yeah, he threatened to beat him up.
Yes. And you can't imagine anyone doing that today. And I think another reason that there's a new edge when people talk about presidential kids that wasn't there 50 or 100 years ago is there's a sense that the whole presidential family has become a partisan matter, in that people see the family as an extension of the president. And if they don't like the president, they see everything as fair game. And I don't think that was there in the same way 50 or 100 years ago.
Well, you're a political reporter. When do you think, if ever, a president's kids should be considered fair game for the media?
I think there's kind of been a sense honed in over the years that when there's governmental matters at stake, when there's legal issues at stake, you're welcome to talk about the presidential kids. And that's kind of why people talked about the Bush twins when they got in trouble in Texas over liquor laws. It's like, we're allowed to talk about this. Something's happened. But I think that's kind of been the rule that's set in, is when there's something else going on, like, write about it. But if it's personal issues, if it's anything small like that, stay back. And I'm sure it's going to keep changing as the media keeps ramping up. And so we'll see what happens. We'll see if it kind of extends into, at what point are we going to start talking about congressional kids, too? Will we ever be at that point?
Oh, I don't know. There's just too many of them, though.
Exactly.
Jamie Fuller writes about politics for The Washington Post. You can read her article, "The Long and Fraught History of Judging the President's Kids," at wordofmouthradio.org. And Jamie, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Of course.
While some presidents were brought into the limelight because of the antics of their children, others have made a reputation for themselves through their very own bad behavior. Nate DeMayo of the Memory Palace brings us the sad story of one such president, near and dear to New Hampshire.
Franklin Pierce was the Mac. He was handsome, he was rich, he was connected. His dad was the governor of New Hampshire. He's in the state legislature at 24, in Congress before he's 30. When he's there, he does Washington up. Early 19th century style, going to all the right parties, flirting chastely with senators' daughters, debating Aeschylus or the Magna Carta or whatever until dawn, and drinking all the time. All the time. He gets a reputation, and he starts to feel terribly about it, and just generally terrible. He's a loud drunk. He's always hungover. He tells a friend he needs to stop, straighten up his act. The friend sets him up with a woman named Jane Appleton, a minister's daughter. She's shy and frail and devout, and Franklin figures that she's just the kind of person he needs to save him from himself. Jane hates D.C. She hates the parties. She doesn't trust her husband's friends, his old drinking buddies. She keeps telling him to quit politics. He's a senator by now. move away from this awful place and its bad influences and its booze. And he does. And they head back to New Hampshire and focus on raising their sons. For a while. He goes off to the Mexican-American War. While Franklin's away, Jane gets depressed and throws herself into her Bible and the temperance movement. And while Franklin's away, he throws himself back into his drinking. He comes back home a war hero, at a time when that sort of thing gets a man nominated for president. Jane doesn't want any of it. She's convinced that if Franklin goes back to Washington, he'll spiral out of control. She starts having visions that tell her terrible things will happen to their family if he runs. They'd already lost two of their three sons to illness. Shouldn't tempt God. But he does. And he wins the election. And Jane is despondent. This is a bad idea. Right before the inauguration, Franklin and Jane and their 11-year-old son Benny take a train trip to attend a funeral of a friend. They get out at one of the stops to stretch their legs, and there's an accident. The train decouples, and one of the cars rolls away. Their son is crushed beneath it. Jane is convinced that Benny's death is a sign. God doesn't want her husband to be president. And right there on the train platform, she refuses to come to Washington with him. And she goes home. He leaves a few days later. He's inaugurated, alone. His last remaining son has just died. His wife is convinced that it's his fault. He's sad and alone. And without Jane to look out for him, he starts hanging out with the boys and drinking. All the time. Spiraling. It takes him 2 years to convince the First Lady to come down to Washington in a last-ditch effort to save him from himself. She spends the rest of his administration upstairs in the White House, alone in a room at the end of the hall, writing heartbreaking letters to her dead son. Soon after they return to New Hampshire, Jane Pierce dies of TB. Soon after that, Franklin Pierce dies of a corroded liver. Also, as a president, he totally sucked.
That story came to us from Nate DeMeo of the Memory Palace. Coming up, from encrypted apps to password protection, we go to great lengths to protect ourselves from hackers. But is free wireless internet making it easier for them to get to our personal information? The frightening reality behind public Wi-Fi hotspots when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. These days, just about every coffee shop, bookstore, and restaurant touts a free Wi-Fi hotspot as a perk of being a customer. It is so convenient that in many cases, you don't even need to sign into the network. Your phone just connects you automatically. But as is often the case with technology, free Wi-Fi comes at a substantial price. Your very own, your digital security. Rob Fleischman is Chief Technology Officer at Zero Coal and our Chief Explainer of All Things Wired. And Rob, it's always nice to have you in the studio.
Great to be here, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics. How do Wi-Fi hotspots actually work when you're using them in public places?
Well, you have to think about a Wi-Fi hotspot as your internet connection when you're at home. So when you're at home, you have your computer plugged in or connected via wireless network to your local network and perhaps through your cable modem or DSL modem out to the internet. And the thing that's nice about having your connectivity at home is it's just like your house. Your house has a front door, it has walls, it has windows. Those things protect you.
Sure.
Just like your cable modem and your DSL modem at home protect you. For example, me in my home, I can't necessarily connect to the devices in your home because I'd have to go through your cable modem or Wi-Fi router that is provisioned by either you or your internet provider. There are things in there that do filtering and firewalling to prevent out bad traffic. But when you bring your device, your laptop, your phone, to a Wi-Fi hotspot, your device doesn't know that it's not at home, it connects to the internet, and away you go. The difference is that when you're in a Wi-Fi hotspot, it's kind of like inviting a whole bunch of people you don't know into your home and letting them plug into your network. The guy at the table next door in Starbucks, he's, you know, a peer of yours now. It's like his computer is plugged into your home network.
And you made a good point. You know, your phone will just automatically connect to a hotspot when I'm visiting a new place. Now, how does that happen, or is that a dangerous thing?
It's actually a very dangerous thing. I'm really saddened that almost all of our devices do that automatically. Let me give you an example. Very common hotspot names might be things like a wireless carrier like AT&T or Verizon or Starbucks.
Right.
Or free Wi-Fi. You know, there are all those things that you see and you know, you say, oh, wow, this is great. I'll connect to that. And then what happens is your phone remembers that. It says, ah, or your computer remembers that. It says, oh, I remember AT&T. That's a free Wi-Fi. And if I see it with that name, I'll just automatically connect to it. And if it has no password, boom, I'm online. So let's say, for example, I'm a bad guy. I might sit in the airport and create a hotspot with the name AT&T. And as you walk by, your phone will just say, oh, wow, look at that. Your phone's sitting in your pocket.
Just because of the name?
Just because the name matches something it used to connect to. So boom, it'll automatically connect. And there you go. I'll be connected to you just like a peer.
Okay, so say this happens. Now I'm connected to a hotspot created by a bad guy, a hacker.
That's correct.
What can he do from there?
Well, there are two things that are interesting. First of all, once he's connected to you, there's generally no firewall between you. So he can probe your device. He can try and see what's going on your device. In addition, he can watch your traffic. So let's say your device goes out and, you know, pings your email provider or website or some app is running. He can watch that traffic and snoop it. So if any of that traffic isn't completely encrypted, the bad guy can watch and see everything you do. And finally, and the worst thing is that really malicious people can create fake versions of known websites. So for example, let's say I create my own Wi-Fi hotspot and you connect.
Okay.
And you say, I want to go to Google. Well, I can say, oh, look, Taylor's phone is asking for Google. I won't send that off to the real Google. I'll respond like I'm Google. And then Taylor's talking to my computer, not the real Google computer.
So he'd reroute me to a page that he created.
That's correct.
And maybe that could be, you know, a login for a bank account?
Exactly.
Or that could be anything.
It could be anything. That's okay. The real problem. You might be tricked into logging in, giving your account credentials. Now, there are a lot of the banking sites, if you'll notice, have things, you know, you type your username and then it comes back with some picture that maybe you pre-configured. And
yes.
Those are terrific. I know all my banking sites do that. And you got to watch for that because a guy who's spoofing, he wouldn't know that, you know, Taylor Quimby has a picture of puppies that comes up when he types his username in.
How did you know it was puppies?
Well, you know, you're just kind of puppy guy. But there are a lot of protections to do that, but not everyone sees that. And nobody really sees that if they're inside of an app, right? The apps are doing connections behind the scenes. So there are pretty much three scary things that can happen when you connect to a Wi-Fi hotspot. The first thing is you're not behind a firewall. So your device, your computer can be probed by all the people that are in the hotspot. The second thing is traffic snooping. If you connect to a hotspot and it's being put out by someone who's evil, they can look at all of your data up and down the internet. And then the third thing is they can fake websites that you might be going to or any type of destination.
Now, are we talking about, say, this theoretical hacker, are we talking about somebody who is like top of the line hacker, like there's really only, you know, a handful of these master spy hackers out there? Are we talking about anybody who does a little research online, can afford the equipment by themselves? I'm like, where's the status of this hacker?
Sadly, the status is going down. I'd say a few years ago, you're talking about people who are quite sophisticated. But now the tools are getting easier and easier to find. So being able to set up your own Wi-Fi hotspot and snoop all those packets, that's pretty easy. I mean, you could do some Googling and figure out how to do that. So the bar to getting into this business is getting lower.
Well, if that's the case, then we need to come up with a way to protect ourselves. So what should we be doing differently, assuming that we don't want to completely avoid using Wi-Fi in public places at all?
The first thing I would do is in almost all your devices, there's an ask to join icon that comes up when you first connect to a Wi-Fi hotspot. And you want to enable that. What I mean by that is when your computer or your phone sees a network it wants to connect to, it should pop up a dialog box and say, hey, Taylor, do you want me to connect to this? Now, you're sitting in Starbucks and all of a sudden it says T-Mobile or AT&T. You want to say, geez, is this a T-Mobile or AT&T place? Do I want to connect to that? It just gets you involved so it doesn't automatically connect to something that might be bad.
So opt in rather than automatic.
Exactly. The second thing I would do is occasionally, and I do this myself, clear all the Wi-Fi hotspots in your computer or phone. And that can be done through the network settings. You know, it's reset network settings and it'll clear all the known hotspots because, you know, you might have hundreds, thousands listed there. And some of them might be auto-connect. So I'd recommend you do that. From then on, you'll be obviously prompted for anything new. And then the third thing is be very careful about accessing sensitive places from free Wi-Fi hotspots, especially passwordless. So, for example, if you're going to log in and do banking, probably not good to do that from the free hotspot in the airport.
Okay, so all that makes sense to me, but I have to admit there's this funny thing when we talk about the dangers of using something like public Wi-Fi for me, because in a sense there's this feeling that, well, there's dangers everywhere. You know, somebody could rob my house at any given point, and yes, I lock the door, but I don't have a, you know, a fancy security system. And the same with my phone. There's this hope for me that there's so many people out there that the convenience of maybe getting to use something like public Wi-Fi outweighs the dangers in the sense that I just might luck out and not be targeted.
Well, let me give you a little bit of ease.
Okay, good. Good.
The bad news is that bad guys are out there. They're being sponsored by countries and companies now. It's not just, you know, a couple nerdy kids in their high school basement. So there are serious people out there. So that's bad. The good news is that we all view the utility of this, and the good guys are coming up with better and better defenses. For example, what I mentioned before about showing images, and there are other two-factor authentication logins. For example, there are websites and, for example, email providers that when you log in, they text a message to your phone to say, hey, you know, you better enter this code in. So it provides another way to authenticate. So more and more, at least important sites, are requiring higher levels of security than just logging in with the app that can be snooped. But you have to be aware of it. I mean, you can't just, you know, if somebody puts up, hey, you know, here's Bank of America, and you just don't pay attention, don't look for the locked icon, the security icon, well, you know, they're probably going to trick you.
Well, Rob, thank you for both scaring me and reassuring me. I appreciate it.
It's a dangerous world out there, Taylor.
Rob Fleischman is Chief Technology Officer at ZeroCol and our Chief Explainer of All Things Wired. We've got Rob's tips for safe surfing at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Been looking for the... All I ever really wanted was Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi. All I ever really wanted was Wi-Fi.
We all know the rules when it comes to creating passwords. Don't rely on basic personal information. Don't use the name of your dog. Use a combination of numbers, lowercase and uppercase letters. And most importantly, don't use the same password for everything. So how come so few people actually follow those rules?
The password I use now is my husband's shield number when he was in the New York City Police Department.
My password for so many of my websites includes a zip code of a place in the Caribbean where I hope to live someday.
But I decided to do my name, Dylan Ward, backwards, which was Knowledge Draw.
But then we realized we both use the same password. We both use our parents' phone number as our iPhone passwords.
Ian Urbina is an investigative reporter for The New York Times, and his article for The New York Times Magazine, called The Secret Life of Passwords, is an intimate portrait of our human need to attach meaning to even the most meaningless aspects of our lives. The article is accompanied by a series of audio interviews. You heard excerpts from just a few of them a minute ago. And Ian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you started collecting people's passwords years ago. Do you remember the first one that made you realize you were onto something here?
Actually, I do, because there was an awkward, funny conversation I had with my cousin where we were talking about our passwords, and we both realized that we had what we now call keepsake passwords, ones that had meaning and sort of a funny reason for them. And mine was an embarrassing admission in that it was Kick Kelly, which was the name of I'm going to sound horribly mean, but it was the name of the dog that we had, and he was a very frustrating dog, always doing things he shouldn't have been. And one day I had to set my password, and I was frustrated at the passwords, and I was frustrated at the dog, and so I combined the two.
And so the idea being you wanted to kick Kelly, the dog.
That's right. I wanted to kick Kelly, and I wanted to kick the passwords, and so I thought I would codify it into a code.
Well, it's funny because as you write about this topic, you sort of tell the story of how a lot of these really personal passwords come out of frustration.
Yeah, I mean, the fascinating thing was the range. You know, so some folks seem to have motivational passwords, you know, kind of the time they wanted to run in the half marathon, or, you know, to quit smoking, or, you know, a reminder to call their mother. Others had a built-in venting mechanism where it was a way to let off steam. And so it might be sort of a joke at the boss's expense, or a nickname for that person you really don't like. And it gives you a sort of chuckle each time you type it in. It's a sort of inside joke with yourself. So, yeah, there's a real diversity in the purpose that people had buried in their passwords.
There's a few really haunting stories from the article. One of the most revealing, for me anyway, comes from a woman that you spoke to, I think just on a park bench, a stranger. And she told you that after her son died, she discovered his password contained a secret that she had never known. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was both a really poignant interaction. In some ways, I marveled that she was telling me this. But the password was Lambda69. And the story was that her son had committed suicide several years earlier. And she had been going through his room and had found a piece of paper at his desk with his password on it. And she, at the time, didn't know anything about Lambda or 69, so she went on the internet and soon started realizing that Lambda is a common historical signature, you know, symbol in gay history, and 1969 is the date of the Stonewall riot,
right.
A key moment, and she started realizing that her son had been gay, something she had not realized before his death.
It seems like this is such a difficult subject to get people to open up about. I mean, we all know we're supposed to keep our passwords secret, and yet you spoke to people on airplanes, this woman on a park bench. Did you have a strategy for talking to people to get them to open up?
That was sort of one of the surprises that kept me going all the while. It was that people were willing, even eager, to tell me these stories, and I couldn't figure out why for the longest time. And I still don't know for sure, but I have a theory. My strategy typically was just to tell them the notion that there's this subspecies of passwords that are not like the rest. They're emotionally imbued and they have a backstory to them. And once it crystallizes, people would register and realize that that spoke to them, and indeed they had one of their own. And my theory was that, you know, people were willing, eager to do that, partially, I think, because there's a collective frustration and tension that we all experience, both from the overload of data in the current moment that we live with, and also just sort of a pervasive fear that is real and legitimate, but hugely weighing on us, a fear of, you know, that we might get hacked. And those two things put pressure on us, and I think there's this cathartic moment that came in these conversations where people said, you know what, I don't care, I'm just going to tell you this, even if I have to go and change my password afterward.
There's one incredibly moving story from the article, and I want to play the audio here. This is an interview with Howard Lutnick. He was chief executive of the financial service firm Cantor Fitzgerald.
Cantor Fitzgerald employed 960 people on the 101st to the 105th floors of the World Trade Center. The plane came in below our floors and eliminated any way that they could get out of the buildings. We lost every single person who was at the office that morning. I said, look, we have two choices. We can close the firm and go to our friends' funerals. 700 funerals, which is 20 funerals a day, every day for 35 straight days. Or we'd probably have to work harder than we'd ever worked before, try to save the firm. The words that came out from everybody were unanimous. They were going to do everything they possibly could to help the families of those who were killed. And the only way we could help them would be to have a company. Our main computers were in the World Trade Center. We have these backup computers. You need passwords to bring them up, but the people who had the passwords were killed. When trying to figure out what the passwords are, you just couldn't ask someone a business question. It didn't feel appropriate, and it wasn't appropriate, but you know, for me to talk to the family was natural and important to me. When you actually understand, you can have a conversation that's entirely different than other people. I couldn't communicate with them in the same way if my brother hadn't been killed. At some point, towards the end of the conversation, I would say, I need to turn my systems on so I can rebuild the company. And they would tell us stuff. And you know, and I would always ask, did he have a nickname? Because sometimes I had learned that people use nicknames as their passwords. And, you know, when you ask a widow, you know, 2 days after her husband was killed, you know, did he have a nickname? And they'd say something like, you know, Batman. And, you know, they would laugh. And So we would have all sorts of conversations, you know, just looking for things that would assist in giving us an area in which to try to break in. And really, for the first 48 hours, what we did is we broke into our own computer systems to rebuild the company so we could take care of our friends' families.
I'm talking about digital passwords as personal keepsakes, and joining me is Ian Urbina. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. That story you just heard came from Howard Lutnick. He's chief executive of the financial service firm Cantor Fitzgerald. Now, that story is so haunting, and it makes me think about the fact that a password is a secret. And so for your password, instead of a random assortment of numbers and letters, people often choose to really reveal secrets about themselves.
In some ways, these are the anti-password passwords, right? So they're not disposable. They're not anonymized. You know, they're not meaningless. They are surprisingly poignant and pretty and personal. And in that Cantor Fitzgerald anecdote, you know, you see that the very thing that we're not supposed to do, the very thing that makes our repertoire of passwords weak, these keepsake passwords, are the very thing that allowed that firm to stay alive.
Was part of your hope with this article, and I'm going to call it a project because it seems like collecting all these passwords is more than just a story, but was part of the idea to document them before they disappear? I mean, it seems like experts all sort of agree that the future of security has more to do with thumbprints and digital keys than it does with passwords, these, you know, random collections of digits.
Yeah, I mean, that was another epiphany along the way, right? That we are immersed in passwords. I think the average person has 40 or so in their life, and we live now. And so we can't think of a time where there wouldn't be passwords. But most people I talk to, sort of who take a long dure view of it, point out that, number one, your grandparents or great-grandparents didn't have passwords of this sort, certainly not as many, and your great-grandchildren probably won't either. So this is a blink in history when passwords are this universal burden that much of the globe suffers. And that struck me as sort of interesting anthropologically. You know, we should study it a little, this institution, the password, the digital password, and also not just study it from a security perspective, but also look at it from, you know, where's its humanity and its illogic and rationality. And so that was part of the goal.
Do you want to share your passwords at all?
I don't. I'm not a digital nudist, as we described in the story, someone who's willing to just throw all care to the wind and put their password out there. I think I'll keep mine secret.
Ian Urbina, investigative reporter for The New York Times. There's a link to his incredible article, The Secret Life of Passwords, at wordofmouthradio.org. And Ian, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll step back in time to the golden age of radio and discover the history of Irving Berlin's classic White Christmas and why it sounds so melancholy for a Christmas song. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
When I'm feeling blue and when I'm feeling low.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. There are several types of songs within the genre of holiday music. There are the religious hymns, the goofy kids songs sung by chipmunks, upbeat pop versions of the classics by Billboard's top artists, and then there's White Christmas. Producer Katie Sewell from the Radio Retrospective brings us the story behind the Irving Berlin classic.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
The holiday season is upon us, and so are the Christmas carols. No doubt you're hearing them in every store you enter. But there is one song that stands apart from the others. It's not upbeat. It's not about fanciful characters, and it isn't religious. It's melancholy, it's wistful, and it's full of longing for bygone days.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. just like the ones I used to know.
White Christmas was written by Irving Berlin, the same songwriter who composed Alexander's Ragtime Band and God Bless America. And people heard White Christmas for the first time ever on a radio show sponsored by the Kraft Company. It was Christmas Day, 1941.
Kraft Music Hall with Bing Crosby, Mary Martin, Victor Borge, Jerry Lester, John Scott Trotter and his orchestra, and the Music Maids and Hal. And here's Bing Crosby.
I like New York in June. How about you?
Bing Crosby and the Kraft Music Hall was a show that mainly appealed to young people. The average listener age was 21. So it's possible that the younger generation embraced White Christmas first. But the longing and coziness of the song had a deeper meaning that day. Families tuning into the Christmas broadcast were thinking about the tragic event that happened just 18 days before.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
The following year, in the winter of 1942, young American troops found themselves overseas during the holidays. An armed forces radio played White Christmas over and over to remind them of home. It's been a permanent part of the Christmas holiday ever since. Bing Crosby recorded the song for distribution in 1942. In an interview, he talked about traveling overseas to perform for the troops.
The song that is most asked for from me over there was White Christmas. Really got so that I hesitated about doing it because invariably it caused such a nostalgic yearning among the men that it made them sad. And heaven knows I didn't come that far to make them sad. And for this reason, several times I tried to cut it out of the show, but these guys just hollered for it.
By the end of the war, White Christmas was the best-selling song of all time. It held that distinction for 56 years. That is, until 1997, when Princess Diana died.
Your candles burned out long before your legend ever will.
Elton John's remake of Candle in the Wind was the first song to really challenge the popularity of White Christmas. But White Christmas is still a part of the holidays. And once you're a part of the holidays, you're in. And it may surprise you to know that unless you were alive in the 1940s, you've never heard the recording of White Christmas that made it famous. The radio premiere of the song on Kraft Music Hall was lost, or taped over. And Bing Crosby's original 1942 master recording, the version heard by the troops overseas, wore out from overuse. The most familiar version is from 1947, when Bing re-recorded the song, hoping to recapture the original magic. For composer Irving Berlin, White Christmas was an unexpected hit. It was a simple song, just 54 words and 67 notes. It was written for a musical review about the holidays, a failed project that eventually became the movie Holiday Inn. Irving Berlin thought a different song from that film would become popular. Here he is.
I had a song in there called Be Careful, It's My Heart, for Valentine's Day. That's the song I picked as the big hit, and it was a fair success. But I also had a song in there called White Christmas.
And that song won him an Academy Award, and is still the best-selling Christmas song of all time. Which is interesting, given the fact that Irving Berlin didn't even celebrate Christmas. He was a Jewish man who immigrated from Russia as a child. And Christmas was a very sad and solemn day for him. While many American families opened gifts around the Christmas tree, Irving Berlin had his own tradition. Every year, he visited the grave of his son, Irving Berlin Jr., who died on Christmas Day, 1928, at only 3 weeks old. Perhaps it is this truly human melancholy that gives White Christmas staying power. 72 years after it first appeared on the radio, you're still likely to turn it up rather than off.
May your day be merry.
I'm Katie Sewell.
Now, I'm a coffee guy, personally, but some mornings nothing beats a tall glass of 100% orange juice. Pure and refreshing as it may be, though, you might be surprised to discover that there's a trade secret behind getting your orange juice to taste especially orange juicy. And while the product may technically be all natural, the process itself is another matter. Clay Wirestone is a contributor to Mental Floss, where he wrote about two semi-secret industry additives, one for orange juice and another for wine. And Clay, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good to be here, Taylor.
So I've always heard that you should be careful of taking natural for granted when you read it in a food label. Is that the case?
That's certainly part of the situation with orange juice. You know, the thing is, the old frozen orange juice in tubes, believe it or not, is probably one of the most natural kinds of orange juice that you can buy, because they pick the oranges, they, you know, pulp them, or they get the juice out of them. The water's taken out and it's frozen. And that was done for a few decades, and that's actually a fairly simple natural process. But what happened was is that in the 80s or so, the big juice manufacturers realized that they could maybe market something a little bit differently, maybe make something a little more appealing by launching what they called, you know, not from concentrate orange juices.
Right.
And the key point here is that they're called not from concentrate. They are not called fresh. And that's because they're not. You know, oranges are really only harvested 2 or 3 months out of the year.
Right.
So in order to have a consistent kind of supply of not-from-concentrate juice, you have to store it. And what they figured out in terms of storing it was you'd take the juice and you would put it in giant vats. The juice would then be in for about a year. But to keep the juice from going bad or oxidizing, they had to take out all the oxygen.
Okay.
What happens when you take out all the oxygen is that you take out most of the flavor.
That sounds like a problem.
Yes. Or the volatile organic compounds that make things smell and taste good, since so much of taste is smell. So what they figured out, and they kind of got with some of the scent and flavor scientists. You know, there's a lot of them in New Jersey for some reason. But these are also folks that do perfumes and the flavorings that are added in other foods.
So I hope you're not about to tell me that there's perfume in my orange juice.
Well, it actually is. I mean, it's basically an orange flavored perfume. Yes. I mean, if you think about it, so much of taste, I mean, taste is very simple. Like, taste is sweet, sour, salty, whatever.
Okay.
What we think of as taste is so much of it is actually smell. So what these flavor scientists did was they figured, well, you know, it's going to look weird if orange juice has, you know, added flavorings on the label.
Well, you couldn't call it 100% juice.
Exactly. So what they did was they gave the flavor scientists the assignment, well, here is some orange peel, some orange oils. You know, in other words, all stuff that's actually extracted from oranges. But now do your magic on it. And so, you know, kind of using these as starting points, the scientists put together what became known as flavor packs. And these these flavor packs are...
So it sounds like Kool-Aid.
Yeah, I mean, more or less. And so then what you do is you'd go into this giant refrigerated vat of orange juice. You'd take out, you know, the juice for the day, and you'd add these flavor packs back in. And it gives you a consistency, too. I mean, that's the other big point here, is that, you know, you could theoretically have orange juice without flavor packs, you know, if you didn't deoxygenate it or whatever. But it would all taste different. And people want certain things. You know, people have, you know, a Minute Maid. I like Minute Maid because it tastes like this. I like Tropicana because it tastes like this. And to ensure that consistency, basically, that's one of the reasons that flavor packs, you know, came into being. I mean, the other thing that's important, as I note in my article, you know, the two leading brands of orange juice, Minute Maid, Tropicana, one's owned by Coke, one's owned by Pepsi. So it's not like the owners of these brands have any kind of special all-natural inclination. You know, these are big multinational brands that want to keep things consistent.
Wait, so are there different flavor packs for different brands? Or
yes,
is it one
yes.
thing
no,
that gets
no,
put in
no,
all
no.
orange Each, juice?
It's actually not only by different brands. It varies by country as well. People in the United States have a slightly different preference for how their orange juice tastes than people in other countries. Minute Maid has one of the most distinctive flavor packs, apparently. It's a kind of a candy flavor, very sweet.
That's exactly how I love my orange juice.
and actually, I mean, folks that have looked into this say that one of the most interesting things about flavor packs is they don't actually make it taste like orange juice. Like, actual orange juice does not taste like flavor-packed orange juice. It is not as sweet. It is not a but because people have certain flavor preferences in their palates, they over the years they formulated these flavor packs to, you know, to kind of be what people want and what people think of as orange juice. But it's not actually necessarily what it is.
Okay, well, it's kind of weird, but overall not harmful, right? We don't have to worry about this.
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's not. And actually, in the orange juice industry, I mean, it's kind of an open secret. I mean, when you have these giant publicly traded companies, these things don't remain, you know, off the radar totally. And it is true. I mean, it is made from oranges, so they're able to say quite accurately it's 100% orange juice. It's more just, if you think about it, we have these kinds of industrial food production processes, and you know, people want to know what's behind that. You know, how are these foods made? How are they actually created?
Okay, well, then let's move to wine, because you also wrote about wine. Mm-hmm. And winemakers are using something that I guess might be considered similar to flavor packs, except it sounds even more like Kool-Aid. We're talking about a product called Mega Purple.
Mega Purple, Mega Red.
Ultra Red.
Ultra
Mega Purple,
red, yeah.
Ultra Red.
Yes, well, so the thing about wine is it's actually much more secret, it's much more under the radar, because, you know, wine is generally created by much smaller companies, you know, and a little more family kind of oriented business. They don't have to be quite as public about what goes on.
And we like to think of it as coming from a certain region and being very, you know, there's a local quality
right.
to wine.
Yes, except for the fact that we also like things to be cheap. I mean, obviously, some people do want to go out and buy the $50 bottle or whatever, but that's a relatively rare occurrence. So if you think about it, though, you know, wine faces a similar problem, which is, you know, certainly in the United States, more and more people like wine. There's the notion that it's good for your health if you're drinking your glass of red wine a day. So you have to make a lot of wine. And again, wine is very variable based on the year. And people have certain things they want to see in wine, particularly your red wines. They want to see it be dark. They want to have it have a real, you know, kind of a fruity aroma and taste. And so that's what Mega Purple, Ultra Red provide. These are essentially super concentrated. It's a super concentrated grape juice.
Mm-hmm.
It sells for around $130 a gallon. And they basically put just, you can literally just put a few drops or so. It's you know, it's less than 1%. Of a bottle of wine. It's sometimes like point 0.4 or something like that.
But it must have a pretty powerful effect.
Well, exactly. It's ultra concentrated. And according to some estimates, it's in basically every bottle of wine that's sold under $20. But at the same time, there's a little bit of dispute in the wine world about it. Because, again, you know, you're talking about something that, you know, what's wine made of? It's made of grapes. What's Mega Purple or Ultra Red? It's grapes. It's, you know, it's concentrated grapes. And this is actually not a new problem for wine producers. You know, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, there would always be an issue that you would get an off year. You'd get a bad crop or, you
sure.
know, the wine would look a little weird. It maybe taste a little funny. And so, you know, in older days, what they would often do is you'd actually just blend another complementary kind of wine in it. Again, I think it's our perception of what a product is, which especially is wine, which I like to think people I think like to think that, you know, it's just kind of squished with your feet and it's put in a bottle and it's put away in a vault. And, you know, 2 or 3 years later, there it is.
So this was news to me when I first read your article. Is this on a label anywhere? Are consumers going to actually read about this when they're buying a product if they wanted to?
No, and that's because, you know, kind of as we've mentioned, with a flavor pack from orange juice, because those starting ingredients are from an orange, even if they're manipulated in a lab, it's still 100%, you know, orange sourced. And it's true. I mean, that's where it starts from. And in, you know, similarly, when you're talking about Mega Purple and the Ultra Reds, you know, again, even though these are hyper concentrated in, you know, it's kind of a product of some lab trickery or whatnot, because they're starting from a grape, it's still wine. It's not something that's required to be labeled, you know, as a separate ingredient.
So after discovering this, your thoughts, should we avoid these additives or accept them as maybe a necessary part of wanting our beverages to taste more or less the same all the time?
I mean, I think in a way it's a triumph of – there's a weird kind of triumph of modern food production there. You know, there's a giant demand for these products. There's a giant demand for them to taste good and consistent. And this is actually food producers reacting to market forces. And certainly, you know, if you're talking about orange juice, you can always buy some oranges and, you know, and squeeze them yourself at home. It is not difficult to make a natural orange juice. And it's certainly not difficult to go out and spend a lot more on a bottle of wine if you want. And you'll probably at that point have something that's, you know, if you're buying something that's, you know, $30, $40, $50, it's probably going to have a little less monkeying around with it.
Well, Clay, thanks for adding a flavor pack to our show today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Clay Wirestone is a contributor to Mental Floss. You can find a link to his article on flavor packs and Mega Purple. And no, we're not talking about Kool-Aid. You can find that link at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for our program on Facebook and Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.